Yeah, indeed. It's 108 here on WWLAMFM.com on Tuesday, September 24th in the year of our Lord 2024. I'm your guest host, Ian Hoke. I'll be sitting in for Scoot, who's taking a couple days off. We expect him back on Thursday. Until then, I'm hanging out with you. I'm hanging out with Coleman, who's in the jar on the other side of the glass on the ones and twos. A little bit later, we'll hear from Joe Cardosi on the traffic. We got Chris Miller in the news department. Everybody's here. You're here. It's going to be a great show. Boy, we got a lot to talk about. You know, I thought we'd start out talking about Russia. And I thought maybe later we'd get to talking about Anti-Gravity Magazine, which is having their 20th anniversary this year. We're going to talk to the editor-in-chief of Anti-Gravity Magazine. His name is Dan Fox. We're going to talk a little bit about the challenges and successes in, running an alt-weekly or monthly, in this case, in the modern era. You know, print media, they've been saying for a long time, you know, print is dead. I remember Peter Venkman saying in Ghostbusters that print is dead. Wait, no, it wasn't Peter Venkman. It was Spengler. Coleman busted me on that right away. Print is dead. Well, anyway, print is not dead. They're doing a 20th year of Anti-Gravity Magazine. Now, if you don't know what Anti-Gravity Magazine is, we'll cue you in on that plenty in the 3 o'clock hour. But just know that it's a monthly publication that comes out in print here in New Orleans. You can pick it up at coffee shops and some other little retail stores around town. Or you can actually get a subscription. You can get it delivered. And there's opinion columns in there, and there's poetry, and there's comics, and there's photography. It's a really nice little magazine. They do a voter education guide that's really got a lot of traction. A lot of people, when it comes to be election time, they go reach for Anti-Gravity Magazine and check out the voter guide, because these guys do a lot of research, guys and gals, I should say. They go and they look at all the different constitutional amendments, everybody running for Bessie and all the juvenile court, all these kind of, I don't mean to suggest that they're unimportant, but most people don't really know how to decide between one Bessie candidate or another, or, you know, somebody running from running for juvenile court to be a judge in juvenile court. Well, Anti-Gravity Magazine goes out and they do all that research for you. So you can read up about the candidates. You can read up about the issues. They give you their recommendation. They say, hey, based on what we know and what we think is important to us here at the paper, here's how we're going to vote. But, you know, here's an objective analysis about the strengths and weaknesses of all these different candidates and the constitutional amendments. It's a really, really useful thing that they do. And they do it not just for the big elections. They also do it for the small ones. So that's one thing I really love about Anti-Gravity Magazine. Again, we're going to talk to Dan Fox about 320. About his magazine and, what role they play in the local media landscape, how they serve content and address issues at the local level. Also, we're going to have some fun today just talking about what was your class song when you graduated high school. I have kind of a funny story about my class song, which I'll tell you a little bit later. But I want to know what your class song was and, you know, what you felt about it. Did you think it was kind of a joke, or did it have some sort of sentimental value? What did it say about your graduating class, if you picked, you know, any number of songs? I printed out a list here of some of the most popular ones. You know, there's obviously that graduation song by Vitamin C from 1999, the Green Day song, Good Riddance, Don't You Forget About Me from 1985, Simple Minds, I Hope You Dance. Can't forget that one. Unwritten, Natasha Bedingfield. Anyway, there's lots of those. Ooh, Don't Stop Believing is on here. I bet that was a pretty fun graduation song. Anyway, we'll talk about what song was playing when they dropped the balloons at your graduation, if you had one of those. I didn't, but I imagine somebody did. And then tomorrow, we'll play some of the best ones on the air. And it's not exactly graduation season, so we won't take up the entire afternoon playing graduation songs. But I thought that might be a nice, fun thing we can do. So at any time today, text in what your graduation song was and what it meant to you, what you think it said about your graduating class. We'll talk a little bit about that today, and then tomorrow we'll play some of those songs. We're going to start out today talking to a reporter from Wired Magazine. Vittoria Elliott is the platforms and power reporter over at Wired Magazine. The United States State Department announced new sanctions on Russian state media earlier this month, accusing Russia Today, or RT, if you're nasty, of working with Russian intelligence to sow discord, disinformation, and unrest in America and around the world. We're going to find out how serious is this threat and what are U.S. spy agencies doing about it. And I can already hear some of you right now saying, oh, here we go. Russia, Russia, Russia. It's all a big Russian hoax. It's all a distraction. It's all a lie. You don't have to understand or appreciate everything about this story in order to possibly wrap your head around that what you're doing is saying the same thing as Russian spies. They really want you to be saying that this is all a hoax. They really want you to be saying that this is all a distraction or it's a democratic, you know, psyop, something like that. I'm not saying that the reason you are saying that is because they got to you, but let's just step back and acknowledge you are saying the same things that they want people to say. You are repeating Russian propaganda talking points. Just putting that out there. And sure, we can, if you want, we can get into the weeds about the Mueller report and the laptop and the hacking and the leaking and all the different sort of facets of this. But where we're going to start out today is very specifically talking about Russia Today, RT, and what they are doing, not just in America, but around the world, in Central and South America, Africa, the Middle East, in some other parts of the world that we don't maybe visit or think about very often. They don't have CNN and MSNBC and Fox News and Newsmax and OAN and News Nation and all these different kinds of things. Mostly what they have is Russia Today. That is where they get the bulk of their television news from in a lot of these places. And the messages that Russia Today is injecting into the living rooms and, you know, dentist waiting rooms and airport lounges in these different countries all around the world is anti-Western, anti-American propaganda that is designed very specifically to make viewers in those countries think more favorably about Russia and less favorably about the United States. I don't think that I should have to explain to you why that's not in America's interest. But there are a lot of different tentacles to this story that merit a thorough going over. So we're going to talk to Victoria Elliott, who wrote this article in Wired magazine. The name of the article is Russia-backed media outlets are under fire in the U.S., but still trusted worldwide. In my other hand here, I have the sealed indictment from the Southern District of New York against a couple people named Konstantin Kalishnikov and Elena Afanasieva. I'm going to say Afanasieva. Just for shorthand, we'll call them Kostya and Lena. And I'm just going to read briefly from this indictment real quick. It's huge. It's a big, fat document. You know these things can be pretty dry sometimes. If you've ever read an indictment, it's a lot of person one and person two and entity one and company three and, you know, exhibit five. So it can be difficult to get through if you don't have a sort of visual aid, but I'll just read the first couple paragraphs for you here, just so we all know where we left this a couple weeks ago. We talked about Tenet Media in Tennessee, which is the parent company of Tim Pool's podcast. And if you don't know who Tim Pool is, that's okay. You're probably better off for it at this point, because it turns out he's been taking a lot of dark Russian money to repeat Russian propaganda to his largely conservative podcast audience. And it seems like he didn't know about it. He denies knowing about it. The indictment says, you know, these individuals that worked at Tenet Media were deceived by their Russian handlers, Kostya and Lena. But if you're taking $100,000 an episode on your podcast, that's what Tim Pool is making. $100,000 per episode, 4 episodes per month. $100,000 a week to do these podcasts. And in his email, in the Discord channel every day, he's getting commands from Kostya and Lena saying, this is what we want you to talk about today. This is how we want you to frame the discussion about Ukraine. This is the framing we want you to use when you're talking about the 2024 election. And Tim Pool and his buddies just went right along with it. $10 million. Russia Today spent to do this. From the indictment, RT, formerly known as Russia Today, is a state-controlled media outlet funded and directed by the government of Russia After Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, RT was sanctioned, dropped by distributors, and ultimately forced to cease formal operations in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the European Union. In response, RT created an entire empire of covert projects designed to shape public opinion in Western audiences. One of RT's covert projects, as described herein, as its funding and direction of a Tennessee-based online content creation company, U.S. Company One, which we now know is Tenet Media, the parent company of the Timcast, Tim Pool, Benny Johnson, a couple others. Kostya and Lena deployed nearly $10 million laundered through a network of foreign shell entities to covertly fund and direct Tenet Media. Tenet Media publishes English language videos on multiple social media channels, including TikTok, Instagram, X, and YouTube, using multiple fake personas. Lena edited, posted, and directed the posting by Tenet Media of hundreds of videos. Many of the videos published by Tenet contain commentary on events and issues in the U.S., such as immigration, inflation, and other topics related to domestic and foreign policy. While the views expressed in the videos are not uniform, the subject matter and content of the videos are often consistent with the government of Russia's interest in amplifying U.S. domestic divisions in order to weaken U.S. opposition to core government of Russia interests, such as its ongoing war in Ukraine. Since publicly launching in or about November of 2023, Tenet Media posted nearly 2,000 videos that garnered more than 16 million views on YouTube alone. Tenet Media never disclosed to its viewers that it was funded and directed by Russia Today, nor did Tenet Media or its two founders and principal executives register with the Attorney General as an agent of a foreign principal as required by law. I'll pause there. There's a lot more dirt in this indictment. Some of it's more interesting than others. But let's shortcut all that and just talk to an expert. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Victoria Elliott, the platforms and power reporter at Wired Magazine. Before we step away, I'll say hello to my friend Coleman. How are you today, bud?
I'm doing fine. After you read that article there, now I'm tempted, based on our conversation yesterday with the expert, to run that through Scopes. one of those fact checks, just to see what they say, just to see if they're going to be biased or unbiased, or they're going to dance their way and say, well, it's kind of like this and that.
Yeah, they might try to both sides it a little bit, but I don't know. This seems, there's not a lot to debate here. I mean, they got the evidence, and it's in the indictment. You know, it's not just, the Department of Justice didn't just put out a press release and say, we think these people have done this. It's a whole ass sealed indictment with exhibits and pictures and emails and text messages and everything. They did it.
That's what makes me curious to see what the fact checkers will say.
I'm curious to see what Snopes says. Well, maybe you look that up while we take a break. I'm Ian Hoke, in for Scoot. Glad to be with you. If at any time you want to get in touch today, the way to do it is the Okunart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. That number is 504-260-1870. You can call me at any time. You can text me at any time. I will read 100% of the texts that you send in today. I'll reply to as many as I can. And the very best ones, I'm going to read on the air, so make them count. We'll be right back after this. I'm Ian Hoke, in for Scoot on WWL. Stick around. That's the number to call if you want to get involved. Call me, text me anytime. Joining us on the line right now, on very short notice, I might add, is Victoria Elliott, the platforms and power reporter at Wired Magazine. Victoria, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. Reading now from this article you published just this morning. Meta has announced that it would ban RT, Russia Today, and other media outlets backed by the Russian state from its platform. YouTube has removed more than 230 channels with connections to Russian-backed media. Those decisions follow the State Department's imposition of sanctions on Russian state media, saying that in addition to spreading disinformation about the war in Ukraine, RT is supporting a crowdfunding effort to support the military's invasion, and they had developed operation directly tied to Russia's intelligence agencies. Victoria, it didn't always used to be this way, did it? Where you couldn't really tell where the distinction was between Russian state media and Russian intelligence.
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, when we're talking about propaganda efforts, there's a long history of that. I think the bigger issue is that, particularly in the online space, you have Russia today and Russian outlets have been very good at sort of cloaking their origin. So, for instance, they had a short form video platform for a while called Ruptly, and that didn't overtly say, like, this is the social media video outlet for RT. You kind of had to dig to figure that out. And so there's ways in which they've really obfuscated where these things are originating. Sometimes they'll have partnerships with local publications, particularly in places like Africa and Latin America, where they are an incredibly popular news source to sort of disseminate stories. And then on top of that, you have sort of what we see with a lot of Russian propaganda and disinformation campaigns, where they may actually back a local news organization, help fund them, or, you know, feed them stories. And so we have these layers of the way propaganda can sort of disseminate. And social media has been a really big part of that. And just like we're all sort of struggling to figure out what's real online, they really kind of take advantage of the fact that, you know, we are not always being the most critical thinkers when we're consuming things online. And there's a lot of easy ways to obfuscate something's origins in those spaces.
It makes me think also about Epoch Times, which, you know, it sounds kind of innocuous. You know, it's usually got cat videos and, you know, people skydiving and things like that. But then occasionally there's a political story. They'll support some sort of angle and people will share that. And they have no idea that Epoch Times was founded by a, like, Chinese separatist religious cult, the Falun Gong. There's just complete opacity in terms of who owns some of these accounts and channels that are disseminating not just political content, but all kinds of content on all these platforms. What a mess. Great. I'm glad you mentioned the Latin American Africa. Let's start there. So what does RT's presence in this region mean for the United States and our interests? What are they doing there? What are they telling their audiences?
Totally. So, you know, I think we have to contextualize this in that, like, Latin America and Africa have been real victims of Western imperialism. A lot of, like, the poverty and corruption that makes them difficult places sometimes are the result of the policies of Europe and the U.S.
Absolutely.
And so that means that, like, an entity like RT coming in and being like, hey, the U.S. is bad for you, or, hey, like, they're trying to mess with you, or they're trying to take your stuff, or they're saying this about the war in Ukraine, but that's not true. It's U.S. imperialism. There's been a big push, particularly in the past 2 years, in the Latin American and African media ecosystems by Russia to really reframe the war in Ukraine as sort of Russia resisting U.S. imperialism. And that is a narrative that feels very resonant to people in those places, because that is pretty resonant with their experiences of us in a foreign policy capacity in some ways. So I think really they're sort of hooking into that space in these countries. And also, I think it's really important to note that, like, they've really invested in sort of, like, the local language and local politics of these places, particularly in Latin America. And so, you know, they have offices in Havana and Buenos Aires. They have journalists who speak the language fluently. And, you know, we have Voice of America. We have similar sort of state-backed news outlets. Mm-hmm. But I think the difference for us is that, at least as far as I know, and who knows what I don't know, you know, Voice of America, based on the 1994 Broadcast Act, it's supposed to be firewalled from other U.S. agencies and from U.S. government meddling in their content. Whereas, you know, Russia, that's not necessarily the case. There is much more of opacity between the state agencies and propaganda and the actual news outlet. But that's not always evident to someone who's a consumer in Latin America, who feels like here's an international news outlet that has this sort of anti-imperialist take, and that in some cases, as you mentioned with the Epoch Times, is sharing factual or completely unharmful content.
Mm-hmm. So what effect are those investments having in this region? Are there, you know, elections or political movements happening in Latin America and Africa that are turning and operating, you know, based in large or small part on this Russian propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big place that you can see this is, you know, in places like the Central African Republic, which have also been places where you know, you have groups like the Wagner Group that's been very present there. And, you know, you see in places like those areas where there's a lot of, you know, historical and well-founded resentment against, in this case, the French and UN agencies. Mm-hmm. And it's also a mineral-rich country. And we've seen, I've seen personally a lot of Russian propaganda really targeting people there around building on resentment to the French, building on resentment to the UN, really framing Russia as this sort of ally to the country. And that's all serving the interests of making sure that the Wagner Group has access to the really important mining resources in the Central African Republic. And so I think, you know, that is not necessarily RT, although RT does have a pretty robust French service. That's also even smaller publications or even Facebook groups. So I think, and that's a really great example of these types of things. I think, you know, we're also, you know, looking at people like Argentina's new president who was elected last year, Milei, who, although he has sort of said supportive things about Ukraine, you know, he has the sort of politics of being a bit more libertarian, right-leaning, that really jives with some of the way that, you know, Russian interests work on the continent. So mm-hmm. I think we see this play out differently in different places, but I do think that it's important to think about, you know, the ways in which, particularly in places like the Central African Republic or poor communities, there's not a hugely robust media ecosystem in these places.
Right.
And so that means that there's a lot of room for maneuvering in a way that there might not be in other countries.
Do you see other efforts from other nations, you know, the sort of ones that we talk about in Western media all the time as being the ones that are, you know, working against us? I'm chiefly talking about Iran and China, I guess. Are they having a similar influence in these regions, or is Russia kind of standing alone in this regard?
I think Russia's been pretty aggressive, but particularly when we're talking about China, you know, there are definitely information operations, but a lot of the way China works is much more sort of economic Belt and Road initiative. And, you know, I spent a couple of years when I was in my 20s living in Accra and then in Nairobi, and there are Chinese infrastructure projects all over these places. And that's a very key component of how China sort of builds goodwill in these regions. In Nairobi, when I lived there, there was one hot pot restaurant. Now there's like a burgeoning Chinatown.
Wow.
And that is, yeah, because Chinese workers are coming there to help build these infrastructure projects. So I think in the ways that we're thinking about diplomacy more broadly, outside of sort of tech and platforms and information operations, that is a really big one. And that doesn't mean China doesn't run influence operations, because they definitely do, particularly targeted at places like the Philippines and Vietnam, where they sort of have these territorial disputes over the South China Sea. That's definitely true. But I think if we're talking about how they're really marshaling their interests, you know, Russia is not necessarily building roads. It definitely is king of the information space in some of these places. But if we're talking about, you know, building entrenched ties into some of these markets, I think the Chinese economic moves are really, really important to contextualize.
That is so interesting. Yeah. Why build a seaport when you could just launch a TV network in a country where they have, you know, one, two TV networks, you know, and suddenly you can become much more influential in that way. Instead of just getting the country to sort of trust you and be economically tied to you, you don't need to be their friends necessarily if you're covertly operating, you know, as a major player in their media ecosystem, and you can just kind of wind them up and point them at whatever your target is that week. That's some pretty pernicious stuff. Victoria, I wonder if I can keep you around about another 10 minutes. I want to take a break, and then I'm going to come back and ask you about more what's happening in the U.S. now that we've covered what's happening abroad. Sound okay?
Sure.
Okay, great. We'll step away. My guest is Victoria Elliott. Victoria is the platforms and power reporter at Wired Magazine. The number to call if you want to ask a question or shoot me a text, 504-260-1870. I will have Victoria probably another 10 minutes here. So, you know, get in touch. Ian Hokin for Scoot on WWL. Be right back.
Oh, yeah, here's a banger.
Slaps. 142 here on WWL AM, FM, WWL.com, and always live on the free Odyssey app. My guest this hour is Vittoria Elliott, the platforms and power reporter at Wired Magazine. Vittoria, thanks for sticking around. I want to bring the conversation back to the U.S. In the last segment, we really kind of did a high dive on what Russian intelligence via Russian state media is doing in developing countries around the world, places that have historically had maybe a contentious relationship with the U.S. and European nations. Let's bring it home. I want to talk to you about what the practical effect is of Meta and YouTube banning these state media outlets. If folks don't know, Meta is, of course, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram. So between Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, Russian media, Russia Today, has sort of lost a big tool in its toolkit in terms of reaching Western audiences. Vittoria, how much of an impact do you think that's really going to have on reducing the spread of Russian disinformation?
Well, I do think it's definitely a blow, because Meta in particular was a really fruitful avenue for RT and for other propaganda efforts. Experts I spoke to said that the accounts for RT, I think, had about 7 million followers on Meta's platform. So, like, it was a pretty impactful channel for them. Similarly, YouTube, the accounts that were removed because YouTube actually began restricting RT after the invasion of Ukraine. But there were a bunch of other channels like this one, African Streams, which, again, does not necessarily say that it is run by RT or by the Russian government, but, you know, was identified as such by the State Department. So YouTube removed about 230 different channels. We don't know all of them that were a part of this. So, I mean, I think it is a really big deal because obviously these platforms are global, right? So even if RT was not super interesting to an American user, like, the reality is that it might still be very interesting to a African, Southeast Asian, Latin American Facebook or Instagram user. So it is a big blow. But I also think, like, that one of the experts that I spoke to sort of mentioned the fact that, like, you know, RT has sort of been setting up this narrative for a while that, like, they might get censored, that, you know, the U.S. doesn't want you to know the truth, sort of thing. So the idea that they might be pulled off these platforms, and while it might damage their reach, could also kind of boost their credibility. Like, yeah, the big bad U.S. and the big bad U.S. tech companies are coming for this truth-telling organization. So I think there's always a way to spin it. And that doesn't mean we're not going to see disinformation and information operations run by Russia as well. They just may not necessarily be packaged with RT.
Yeah, there's always that kind of backfiring effect, right? Where if you say, "Well, we're gonna ban you because you're breaking the law or you're breaking the terms of service," then they just go somewhere else, and they say, "Oh, well, now we're being oppressed. Now we're the victims here." And I'm thinking about how, you know, if you kick everybody off YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, they're just going to end up on Rumble and Twitter and, you know, whatever else. It'll always be Twitter on this program. And those places have much less restrictive content policies, but they still have big audiences. So it's kind of playing whack-a-mole here.
Totally. And, you know, I thought it was very funny that the day after the ban happened, RT on X, formerly Twitter, posted this tweet saying, "Here are our accounts on all these other platforms." It was VK, which is sort of the Russian version of YouTube, Rumble, as you mentioned, Gab, and obviously on X. And, you know, what they said is, you know, Meta can ban us all they want, but you can always find us here. And I think this is such a particular thing because a lot of times these companies don't coordinate with each other, right? And so it means that Meta could have perfect enforcement around anything, hate speech, disinformation, propaganda, etc. But if it's still spreading on other platforms, A, it will almost always find its way back. But B, you know, there's only so much one company can do. So I agree. It's definitely like playing whack-a-mole, especially because all these platforms sort of have different policies in general. And on top of that, they're not necessarily communicating with each other.
Yes, and some of them have erratic, mercurial, narcissist sociopaths that own them and kind of say they're, I'm a free speech absolutist, so bring in your lies, bring in your Russian propaganda, more neo-Nazis, and that's why that website is the way it is today. So you've highlighted in your article that Russian media will cede stories to smaller publications, right, and then also make use of local digital influencers. Let's go back, and it's been a couple weeks, and I just kind of want to get, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, the way that we talk about Tenet Media and what happened with Tim Pool and Benny Johnson and some of these other people that were on the direct payroll of these Russian individuals that are now indicted by the Department of Justice. Is that do you think that's the end of that story, or is it possible that there are other influencers, podcasters, media personalities out there that are still carrying water for Russian intelligence, and either their audience is unaware or the U.S. government is unaware? How big is that threat? Or do you think Tenet Media and that saga was kind of the alpha and omega of that effort?
Wow, you've actually hit on something that I have spent a lot of time thinking about. I can talk about some of it now, and some of it will be reporting later. But my answer is that, first off, with the Tenet Media thing, I think in the indictment it said there were hundreds of influencers on the payroll, but a lot of them don't know they're working for Russian campaigns, right? Mm-hmm. They just know that, like, they're being given information with a certain angle, maybe to boost or to reshare or whatever. And I think, first off, like, the influencer space is the next frontier of information operations, and that's because it is so much more opaque. You know, it's easier to hide money if you're paying into a shell company who pays another shell company who pays a marketing agency who pays the influencers on their payroll. It's so much easier to hide these things that way. It's also more difficult to show that stuff is networked. You know, there's all these other ways of obfuscating things that I think we are just 100% not ready for yet. But I do think that, like, you know, with Tenet, you had maybe a couple of people who kind of knew what was up. But even then, they were dealing with, you know, most people thought they were dealing with this capricious European billionaire who wanted to back some YouTube channels and a media outlet. They didn't think they were dealing with a Russian-backed influence campaign. And I think that is actually probably going to be really common, where influencers or media professionals think that they are dealing with one entity and sharing content with a certain sort of political view on behalf of one entity, but it's actually an influence operation. Similarly, I think, you know, we see this a lot even with, like, in the health space. You know, there's a lot of vaccine skepticism. I recently wrote a piece on astrology online and how it's very popular. And it's very easy to go from, like, reading your daily horoscope into a sort of QAnon rabbit hole. The algorithm sort of funnels you that way. And so you, as an influencer who might like charging your crystals and care about when the full moon is, might end up in the orbit of another influencer who's spreading anti-vaccine content, and they could also be a propaganda, like an influence account, and you might be liking their stuff, which boosts them up in the algorithm because that's how these platforms work. You know, I think there's a lot of ways in which there's a lot of unwitting participation in these things, whether it's people resharing content that it turns out is part of these networks, or influencers who think that they're working for one person and they're working for someone totally different, you know. I think that's what makes them so hard to track.
Man. Yeah, if the DOJ doesn't get involved, then there's no accountability for any of these people. I think that, you know, an enterprising reporter like yourself or somebody else could have blown this story up and said, holy cow, Tim Pool, this really pretty influential person online who's got, you know, millions and millions of views and millions of subscribers, is taking $100,000 per episode from Russian state media. That seems to me, and I'm sad about this, this is really unfortunate, that seems to me like the kind of story that's going to wash out of the news cycle in like 36 hours. And next week, Tim Pool's still going to be back with a new episode. So I wonder if do you agree or disagree with that? First of all, let me just put it to that way.
You know, I think the way the news cycle moves is incredibly fast. And, you know, that is the product of our modern internet. I think that, like, unfortunately, all this stuff, like, I mean, if I just go back and think about, like, all the big things that I have reported on in the past, like, couple of years, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I fit all that in my brain. You know, I think we're all a bit overwhelmed. And I also think, you know, maybe the public's detriment, the media can often treat each of these stories like a distinct thing. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this tenant media thing, and then this RT thing, and then also maybe this other thing and this other thing. And I don't know that we always do a great job of mapping out the scale of the problem. And also, like, we're trying to be empathetic to our audiences, right? Like, maybe our audience would not want to, like, read hundreds of thousands of words mapping all of this out, doing the, like, you know, the thing like Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia with the board, you know, like
the red
maybe
string.
Our audience, maybe that's not helpful to our audience. But I think, you know, as a reporter, I know there's so much like information and connections that I just sort of keep in my head because I cover these things that most normal Americans are not really keying into. And that's okay. That's like, it's not the job of every U.S. citizen to have a murder board in their mind to, like, wonder if the thing that they're interacting with on Instagram after a long day at work is an influence campaign, you know. But I do think that, you know, but that's a real challenge for us as a media industry, and a real challenge, obviously, for the government. And I don't have a solution. We are not in a position to tell capitalism and the platforms behind it to slow down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that would be an effective use of our time anyway. We better stop here, Victoria, but boy, I've really enjoyed talking to you. This was a great conversation. You made yourself available on extremely short notice. Thank you so much for your time, your work. It's so important. Thank you for your work, and thank you for your way. Have a great week. We'll keep in touch, okay?
Thanks so much.
All right, Victoria Elliott is the Platforms and Power Reporter at Wired Magazine. You can go read her work at wired.com. Thanks again, Victoria. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot. Right here on WWLAMFM.com and the Odyssey app. I got time for a couple of your reactions before we hit the news at 2 o'clock. Shoot me a call. Shoot me a text. 504-260-1870. BRB. 156 here on WWL. A lot of that was there's the Tragically Hip. That's fun. Oh, man, we got some bad news about Eric McCoy today. Saints center exited early on Sunday with a groin injury. He's expected to be out maybe 6 to 8 weeks. Jeff Nowak has that story up now at WWL.com. Also, I want to let you know about we're doing the WWL Saints Game Day Giveaway, a special double edition of the Saints Game Day Giveaway. If you want to be in that number when the Saints host Tampa Bay and Sean Payton and the Denver Broncos, you just enter to win, man. You can score a pair of premium game tickets to both of those games, Bucks and Broncos, plus VIP tailgate passes from Bullseye Event Group, an open bar with premium liquor, the good stuff, not that cheap, weirdo, off-brand, well liquor, the good stuff. I'm talking your Grey Goose, you know, Hendrix Gin. They got all that up there. Plus, you can hit that all-you-can-eat buffet from celebrity chef Aaron May, all overlooking Champion Square. Scoot and I have done this together a few times, and it's a damn good time. I mean, you go up there, you got a great view overlooking Champion Square. There's all this delicious food. People are partying and dancing. There's delicious food. I'm trying to remember some of the things I ate up there. There was like prime rib and some sort of like a crawfish pie or something. I don't know. It was a couple times, and it was last year, so it's been a minute. But damn, Aaron May, don't play. Get some of that buffet. Wow. Winning is very easy. Just go to WWL.com/contests, and that's your chance to win tickets to Saints Tampa Bay and Saints Denver. That's from Dudley DeBosier, official injury lawyers of the New Orleans Saints and WWL. Here's a text that says, how can you name drop Tim Pool? Do you have any proof at all that he's being paid by the Russians? Yes. I'm holding in my hand a 32-page criminal indictment laying out the case that Tim Pool is being paid by Russia. And Tim Pool and Dave Rubin and Benny Johnson and a couple other people, Lauren Chen, have acknowledged that this happened to them. And they have denied knowing that it was the Russian government via Russian state media that was paying for their services in conservative online media. to say, oh, we shouldn't be in Ukraine. We shouldn't be supporting the Ukrainians. We shouldn't be letting in the immigrants. We shouldn't be voting for Kamala Harris, etc. They're claiming that they're innocent, that they're just innocent victims and all that. And I'll take it with their word. But if somebody came to me and Coleman today and said, we're going to pay you $100,000 a day, here's the script, I'm not buying that. Here's the news. We'll be right back.